Lions. It's an interesting one because the author, Jonathan Kaufman, has chosen to write the book in form of serial biography. That is, he uses the story of five individuals and one family, half black and half Jewish, and uses the lives and activities of these people to chart the course of black-Jewish relations over the past 30 years. He also says that while it is a political story, it's also a very personal one, that what he was trying to do is come to understand why that alliance between blacks and Jews touched people so deeply, why it created such hope, and why it produced so much anger and bitterness as it collapsed. And again, the book is Broken Alliance. Mr. Kaufman is joining us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Pleased that you could be with us.
So it's nice to be with you.
I'd like to start off by asking you a question that you really pose in the introduction to the book, and that is why it matters. Why should anybody care about blacks and Jews, the fact that there once was this alliance and then that was followed by this falling out?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. I think one of the reasons is that, you know, we tend to forget the country has changed so dramatically in the past 25 years. I think we tend to forget what this country was like back in the late 1950s and early 1960s, when there was still segregation in the South, when it was still a very hard place, not only for Jews to live because of bigotry and anti-Semitism that still existed, but really for many people who didn't fit in. And the Civil Rights Movement, I think, changed this country in an extraordinary way. And for all the bitterness that has grown up between blacks and Jews, what these two groups did back in the early 60s, I think, changed the way that all of us live today. And so I think the alliance and its breakup is important because, in a sense, as blacks and Jews have broken up, they've enervated liberal causes. They have clearly caused tremendous strains in the Democratic Party. I think from a purely pragmatic point of view, we see now with the strains inside the Democratic Party between Jews and Jesse Jackson that unless they're able to reach some sort of accommodation, they may well, you know, rip the Democratic Party apart. The other part, which I think is in a sense is equally as important, is to remember that this country is getting more diverse, not less diverse. I mean, we're seeing that now with a tremendous influx of Asians and Hispanics coming into this country. You can go to places like California, for example, and it seems as if soon there will be no majority population. Whites will make up 40%, blacks 20%, Hispanics 20%, Asians 10%, and so forth. So I think that for all the kind of trouble that blacks and Jews have had that I talk about extensively in Broken Alliance over the past 20 years, we have to remember that these two groups created something unusual, a true interracial coalition. And I think if we can understand what it was that brought these groups together and then what went wrong, it may be able to give us lessons for the whole country about how different groups can work together and what different groups have to do as all the various parts of the quilt that this country is becoming begin to live and work together in the next 20 and 30 years.
Yeah. In the first part of the book, you tell the story of two men in this, as you're talking about the period of cooperation in the early phases of the civil rights movement. And you talk about a Jewish lawyer named Jack Greenberg, who for a long time was the head of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Mm-hmm. In fact, he succeeded Thurgood Marshall in that position. I guess the thing that strikes me about him, and also I think is true of the other man that you profile, a black civil rights activist named Paul Parks, is that somehow they saw the civil rights struggle as being everyone's struggle. That is, moving towards an America where there was greater freedom and individual liberty would be a good thing for everybody.
Well,
in particular, both blacks and Jews that seemed to see both themselves and each other as a people that were oppressed in some perhaps similar ways.
Well, I think that's true. In fact, one of the most powerful stories I think I tell in the book is one that Paul Parks tells, which is that in 1945, Paul Parks is in the Army. He's an engineer. He's black, but even though he's trained as an engineer, the Army is still segregated in 1945, and blacks are at the very bottom of the hierarchy. They're in charge of sort of scut work. They run the bulldozers and the tractors and so forth. So in 1945, when Paul Parks' unit is on the outskirts of Munich, he receives word that next morning they're going to be going into an army camp called Dachau. Now Paul Parks doesn't really know what Dachau is. He assumes it's some sort of an army camp. And And he doesn't quite know why his unit is going to be going in first, because usually for any sort of an action like that, the white infantry groups would go in. Of course, the next morning he discovers why his unit is set in first, because in addition to being the people who run the bulldozers and build the bridges, the black units are also the burial squad. And they go in and then they see the bodies lying around in the concentration camp. And Parks is stunned by what he's seen. He can't figure out why these people are there and why there's so much death and so much suffering. And a few hours later, another army company comes in with a chaplain, a rabbi. And Parks says to him, why are these people here? What did they do? Were they prisoners? Because they're dressed in prisoner uniforms. And the rabbi says, no, they didn't do anything. And Parks said, but there must be some reason why they were put here. And the rabbi says, well, they were put here just because they were Jews. And Parks, who's 20 years old at that point, sits down on the ground and he says, well, I understand that because I've seen people lynched just because they're black. And so I think you're right. I think that much of what brought blacks and Jews together in those early civil rights days was this sense that they shared a common enemy, that bigotry and prejudice was harmful not only to blacks but to Jews as well. Jack Greenberg, who, as you point out, was for 25 years the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and probably after Thurgood Marshall, one of the greatest civil rights lawyers of that entire time, used to say over and over again, this is not a Negro problem, it's a human problem. And I think in a way that's also part of the leadership of the civil rights movement. You know, we tend sometimes to maybe romanticize the early 1960s and say, well, wasn't that a wonderful idealistic time of Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy? But it is hard for me to speak to blacks and Jews who lived through that time without getting a sense that it really was different, and that one of the things that King and others did was to say that the civil rights movement was not just a black cause, but was an American cause and was a patriotic cause and a religious cause. And I think one of the things that's changed so sadly in this country over the past 25 years is that we seem to have lost that unity of vision. The country seems much more polarized. People tend to have their own self-interests and follow them along. And I think that really starts in the late 1960s, and black Jewish cooperation is in a way a casualty of that.
Yeah. Well, these two men, Greenberg and Parks, really seem to straddle the two eras. They in a sense, have one foot in the era of cooperation and one foot in the era of confrontation. Mm-hmm. And I think of, I think Greenberg is a good example because of the incident involving his being asked to teach a course on law and civil rights at Harvard.
Right.
He was asked, I guess the people at Harvard decided that it was something that the university, the law school, should address, and asked
right.
a rather prestigious black attorney, Julius Chambers, if he would teach the course. Chambers said, well, I'm not sure I can make that commitment, but I know someone that I could work with and perhaps we could teach it together. And he suggested Greenberg. And it was met with a great sort of anger by young black law students at the time who felt that if anybody was going to teach a course like that, it should be somebody who was black. And it somehow, this was representative of an emerging feeling among blacks, apparently especially young blacks, that their struggle was their struggle. And if anybody was going to lead it, it should be a black person. That somehow, no matter what a white person had been through, even a Jewish white person, their experience was different, and there was no way that they were going to understand what it was like to be black.
Right, I think it's true another issue in that whole struggle was the question of appointing more black faculty to Harvard. I think a lot of the black students saw it as a delaying tactic, that by bringing in someone like Jack Greenberg on a part-time basis, it prevented Harvard from hiring more tenured black faculty. And I think you're right that in a sense, in one man's life, in Jack Greenberg's life, you really see the distance that blacks and Jews have traveled from a time when Jack Greenberg was on the front lines helping James Meredith get into the University of Mississippi and fighting for civil rights, to a time when he comes to Harvard in 1982 and teaches a course on civil rights with black students picketing outside. In much the same way, I think you're right, Paul Parks does straddle that era as well, because after he leaves the Army, he gets very involved in civil rights, works with Martin Luther King, fights for desegregation here in Boston of the schools, and always finds that Jews are on his side. But in 1968, after King is killed, there are riots here in Boston, and black students begin rampaging through the black neighborhoods here and singling out Jewish stores and attacking stores that are owned by Jews. And Paul Parks leaves his desk and rushes down to that neighborhood and barricades himself in front of the hardware store of a Jewish friend of his. And Paul Parks can't understand what's happening. I mean, it doesn't make sense to him from his experience that young blacks are now singling out Jews, that they're rioting, that they're turning against whites in this way. But, of course, one of the things that happens in the late 1960s, and this is in a way sort of the middle section of my book, with the rise of black power and the changing focus of the black struggle, is that many blacks do begin to feel that they want more control over the direction of the civil rights movement. They begin to ask for different things. And, you know, they very often don't want Jews or whites around. They want to control their own struggle.
Yeah. Our guest this morning on Focus, Jonathan Kaufman, we're talking about his book, Broken Alliance, The Turbulent Times Between Blacks and Jews in America. If you're interested in being a part of the conversation, we welcome that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller on the toll-free line who's been waiting for a bit, so we'll bring them into the conversation right now. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a graduate of Roosevelt University here in Chicago, and I also hung out in the civil rights and peace movements, and I think the thing that didn't surprise me about the turn that we both saw from black and Jewish cooperation, the thing that did not surprise me is that it happened, because I think what your guest may have missed is the larger historical picture. I'm basically a person who was raised as a Catholic. I hated that early on, but I saw some of the meanness of spirit that the Catholics had, and it's a couple of characteristic statements, Christ killers and things like that, that I saw and rebelled against. And I think that we whites have created blacks literally in our own image. In other words, we gave them a Christian faith that emphasizes that Christ killer attitude, and I don't know that we can expect anything but the logical conclusion of that to result. That in other words, acting on those given assumptions, blacks are doing exactly what whites have done for thousands of years in other countries as well as here. And my part of the civil rights movement, both at Roosevelt and hanging around in Hyde Park at the University of Chicago area, I found that it was always the most liberal Christian churches, particularly the American Friends Service Committee or the Quakers, who did the most during the civil rights movement. And next to them were the Unitarians and some of the other, you know, they're not necessarily a Christian group. So that I saw a great lack of support from the traditional fundamentalist Protestant or organizations like the Catholic Church through the whole period. Only much later in the movement did you see a few nuns. Daniel Berrigan, for instance, was always an outcast in his own faith for his support of the civil rights and peace movements. And I think whites, clearly white Christians, those who profess Christianity, bear not the blame, not the blacks. The blame lies with standard Christian undercurrent teaching, I call it. And there is that, clearly, in Catholicism, definitely, Christ killer. I heard that more than once in my 8 years in the elementary school and elsewhere.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I think it's a bit more complex than that. I mean, one of the things I discovered in writing Broken Alliance, sort of looking at the history between these two groups, is that while it's true that blacks did, growing up in the South, you know, have many of those anti-Jewish images from Christianity, there was also a whole body of very positive images from Christianity. For slaves down South, for example, the whole Exodus story, the story of the Jews leaving Egypt, was the most powerful story for most blacks growing up South. If you even look at the names of most black churches, Ebenezer Baptist Church, you know, Mount Bethel Baptist Church, these are Old Testament names. And I think that for blacks growing up in the South, they had a very powerful connection with Jews, because the story that resonated most strongly with them was the story of Jews enslaved in Egypt and leaving there. And of course, you know, the first great protest song is a song that Jews sing at Passover as well, which is, "Go down, Moses, tell Pharaoh to let my people go." I think as James Baldwin and others have written extensively, these images almost existed side by side in black minds. It was interesting. I was talking to a black anthropology professor, a very well-known one, and sociologist, St. Clair Drake, who's now in his 70s, and he told the story of walking through Virginia back in 1920s, I guess, with his grandmother. And the Jewish family in town was the only family that would ever invite them up on their veranda on a hot day to have a cool drink. But at the same time, Drake said, it was common practice that when he went back home that the family would talk about Jews overcharging them in their stores and so forth. So I think in both religion, economics, sort of a whole range of areas, the blacks had very almost at times contradictory but certainly very ambivalent views of Jews. And I think it's especially true in the religious context. I think the role of Christian anti-Semitism is clearly important. But I would argue that through the Black Power movement and the disputes we're seeing more recently between Jews and Jesse Jackson and so forth, I think it's really much more a struggle over power. It's really an effort by blacks and Jews, that blacks and Jews now have conflicts of interest on a whole range of issues, Israel, the Middle East, affirmative action, we can sort of go down the list. And I think that religion may play a part in it, but I think for many blacks it also played a positive role in those early days especially.
I guess I'm still left with the feeling that if it's true that the ties were so between blacks and Jews were so deep, how did the relationship seem to come apart so easily?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, I think I think that the ties appeared quite deep, and at some level were, but I think there were a lot of factors that led to them. You know, blacks and Jews, I think, were brought together almost by intersecting agendas. If you look at the late 1950s, I mean, it was still a time when there were neighborhoods that Jews couldn't move into, jobs they couldn't hold. The Holocaust was still a very recent memory for many Jews. And so when Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement comes along and talks about a movement that's going to knock down barriers of discrimination and open up the society, Jews respond to that, and they respond to it out of a very positive, enlightened self-interest, because they know that while that will be good for blacks, it will also be good for Jews. Blacks, I think, historically, really for more than 100 years, had been divided, moving back and forth about strategies of dealing with white society. Do you go the more separatist route, the more nationalistic route, as people like Marcus Garvey or Malcolm X suggested, or do you go a more integrationist or cosmopolitan route, as Martin Luther King and others proposed? For reasons internal to the black community, I think, starting after the Second World War, that integrationist strain rises to the fore. You have blacks reaching out for white allies, and Jews are wonderful allies if you're looking for white allies. So this kind of common interest brings blacks and Jews together. But starting in the late 1960s, those interests begin to diverge. These days, on issues that both sides feel very passionately about, like Israel, like affirmative action, like Israel's ties to South Africa, like the significance of Jesse Jackson, black and Jewish interests are no longer the same. That natural coming together no longer exists. I also think that blacks and Jews had very high expectations of each other. My sense in talking to blacks for Broken Alliance is that they never really expected very much from white people, but they did expect more from Jews, in part because of the history of Jewish involvement in the civil rights movement and the NAACP going back to almost the turn of this century, by some of the personal encounters they had and by the astonishing commitment that Jews showed to civil rights. Paul Park said to me at one point, he said, you know, I knew three kinds of people growing up, black people, white people, and Jewish people, and Jews were the good white people. So when Jews begin to move away from the civil rights struggle in the late 1960s, I think blacks are very angry. They somehow feel that they've been betrayed. Jews, for their part, I think, were long conditioned to worry about anti-Semitism from the right, but begin to be very worried when they see attacks on Jews and attacks on Israel coming from black groups, from the left, starting in the late 1960s. So, in a sense, the sort of same passion and commitment that brought blacks and Jews together, when it began to fall apart, that passion sort of was turned into anger. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's so much bitterness today.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems, you know, in another section of your book, you talk about the conflict that in part came out of the New York City school strike, and it's sort of a complicated bit of history to explain. But I I guess in short, I would say I could also understand there being some resentment by blacks towards Jews, because there have been instances where I think Jews have used generally anti-Semitism in general and black anti-Semitism in particular as a kind of political weapon that they tried to use to their own advantage.
Well, what happens in that New York City school strike in 1968, the Ocean Hill Brownsville controversy, is that basically, and the person I focus on to tell that story is Rhody McCoy, who was the black head of that district, is that you have a poor black school district in New York where kids are doing very badly, they're underachieving, they're barely getting an education at all. And black parents and people in the community want to have more of a say over how their kids are taught, what they're taught, sort of more control over the school system. So with the cooperation of the Board of Education, they set up this experimental school district in Ocean Hill, Brownsville. And Rhody McCoy is brought in. Rhody McCoy, who has been a follower of Malcolm X, who comes in and tries to turn that district around. Well, one of the things he discovers is that his opponents, when he tries to fire teachers or change things, are not bigoted white Southerners or Southern sheriffs with police dogs. They're Jews, middle-class Jewish teachers. The teachers in New York were overwhelmingly Jewish at that time. Many of these teachers were liberal. They had marched down south, and they saw these changes as threatening their own livelihood, their jobs, their security. What happens midway during the strike is that someone, it is later determined, some sort of fringe element of the black community, put anti-Semitic leaflets in some of the teachers' boxes up in Ocean Hill, Brownsville. And the teachers' union then reprints those by the hundreds of thousands and distributes them all around New York, and the strike explodes into a debate over black anti-Semitism and Jewish racism. I agree with you that I think in the end the decision by Albert Schenker and the teachers' union in New York to reprint those leaflets and focus on the issue of black anti-Semitism was tactically a brilliant move. In other words, it clearly shifted the debate from one over education to one over black anti-Semitism. But I think in its consequences for New York and for black Jewish relations, it was devastating. I don't think New York has ever recovered from that teacher strike. I don't think black Jewish relations ever have either. And the bitterness that lingers from that strike, I think, is still quite prevalent. And I must say, I think on the issue of black anti-Semitism, and I've been doing a great deal of speaking about the book, about Broken Alliance, and about this whole issue over the past few weeks, and I'm asked constantly by Jewish groups about black anti-Semitism. Is there a rise of black anti-Semitism? The concern, obviously, in Chicago recently when Steve Coakley made those comments about Jewish doctors injecting the AIDS virus into black babies scared many Jews. And so Jewish groups are always asking me, well, are blacks more anti-Semitic, especially in universities? Is there a rising tide of black anti-Semitism in universities? One of the points I try to make is that I think Jews have to differentiate between black anti-Semitism, which I think represents a small segment of the black community, I think clearly Farrakhan is anti-Semitic and so forth, and a much larger number of blacks who I think are hostile to Jews because they feel that Jews are in turn hostile to their interests. In other words, you can be a black in Chicago and see that Jews are hostile to Jesse Jackson. They're opposed to affirmative action. They're on the other side of questions of the Middle East. And because of this tangled history that we've talked about, I think many blacks say, look, I just don't like Jews. I can't deal with them. I just have nothing in common with them. That's different, I think, than anti-Semitism, in part because I think it's very hard to have a conversation or a dialogue or a meeting of the minds with someone you consider anti-Semitic, the same way it would be hard to do that with someone you consider racist. So I think there is a way in which we have to lower the level of rhetoric between blacks and Jews, and try to figure out what are genuine conflicts of interest that blacks and Jews can talk about and try to hammer out some working arrangement, and what may be sort of more fringe or irrational elements of the black community that may be anti-Semitic. One of the people I profile in the book who I think is very important is Donna Brazile, a young black woman who worked for Dukakis in the last campaign and became famous because she made some comments about George Bush's personal life and had to step down from the Dukakis campaign, but I think also made some very astute remarks about racism in the Bush campaign. I focused on Donna Brazile because I wanted to hear what a young black woman thought of this alliance and thought of this whole question of black-Jewish cooperation. And I think what's clear from talking to her and to other younger blacks is that, you know, many blacks say, look, we're willing to have an alliance, but it has to be an alliance of equals. As Donna Brazile said to me, I'm willing to work with anybody, but my top priority is to do what's best for black people. Those are conflicts of interest and that are going to have to be negotiated, that there's going to be a lot of dialogue about. But I think that we'd all benefit from kind of lowering the level of rhetoric that tends to surround these encounters and sort of stop hurling insults at each other and maybe try to figure out a little bit why the other person is feeling certain kinds of pain.
Yeah, we're here about midway through the program. We're talking with Jonathan Kaufman about the relationship between blacks and Jews in America. He's written a book about that that's recently come out. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk show. My name is David Inge. We're talking this morning with Jonathan Kaufman. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe who has written extensively on black-Jewish issues, and he's the author of a recently published book on that topic. The title of his book is Broken Alliance. We have callers here who'd like to be a part of the conversation, so we'll get right back to the phones, starting with someone on our toll-free line.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
I'm calling regarding your guest... people who called in recently. Anyway, I'm saying that I went through the Catholic schools for 12 years. I never heard a word there against Jewish people or blacks. Our religion is based on the teachings of Jesus, who was a very gentle person and was, in fact, taken away. An angry mob took him to crucify him, but I've never heard anything against the Jewish people or even the Jews of that time. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Any comment on that, Ms.
Well, no. Kaufman? I mean, I think that you know there's clearly been a strain of teachings in many Christian among Catholics and others that have been muted since Vatican II. I think that's one of the things the Pope has clearly tried to do is to change some of the historical. Historical teachings about Jews that many Christians heard, and I think it's good that the caller was never exposed to that. I think though that we have to be honest and understand that in this country still, there are people who don't like blacks, who don't like Jews. I mean, who don't like Catholics. I mean, there's still a great deal of resentment and prejudice in this country. I think the rise of the groups like the Aryan Nation and the Skinheads are one manifestation of that. I guess what I think is important about this black-Jewish alliance about the stories I tell in my book is that despite the fact that blacks and Jews, in a way, did come from very different backgrounds, did have very different ways of looking at the world, they were able to work together. And understanding that, I think, as I said earlier, is important because as the country becomes more diverse, you know, we're all going to be facing those sorts of challenges.
Yeah, let's take another caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hi, first of all, I just wanted to comment on the last caller. For those who were raised with such a anti-Semitic Christian teaching or supposedly Christian teaching, I'd like to remind them that they should know that Jesus was very much a Jew. But aside from that, this is a question a bit out of ignorance, but it sounds to me from what you were saying so far that there was difference in Jewish-black relationships between that in the South and that in the cities of the North. Is that so? And is it because of their history? Was their history different? Is their outlook on things different?
Well, I think it was. I think, I mean, the fact is that down South, there were very few Jews down South. And so I think the way that many blacks got to know Jews down South was through the Bible, was through the stories they heard about the Exodus and so forth. It was through the kind of positive word of mouth of Jews being involved in the civil rights movement. And it was through exposure to Jews, which very often during the civil rights movement, most of the Jews who went down South, Jews made up two-thirds to three-quarters of the whites who went South during the Freedom Rides and during the voter registration drives of 1964. They were deeply involved in sort of all aspects of the civil rights movement. Most of those Jews tend to be very liberal, even left-wing. And I think for especially blacks in the civil rights movement, the Jews they met really represented a sort of extraordinary political awareness. I think that what happens when the civil rights movement comes north is that blacks and Jews meet on a different battleground. Clearly in northern cities, in Chicago, New York, everywhere, blacks and Jews had lived and worked often side by side in ghettos. Jews had a number of stores in ghettos, and blacks very often resented what they felt were high prices, the fact that Jews were landlords. I mean, someone said in the 1960s that of the five people that a black in a northern ghetto met during the course of a day, the store owner, the landlord, the social worker, the teacher, and the cop. Four were Jewish, and one, the cop, was Irish. I think that was true, and I think that, that for many blacks, growing up in a ghetto, you could look around and see that it seemed like, you know, Jews controlled everything. And there's an unequal distribution of power in those situations. Another thing that really hasn't been talked about a lot, which I devote sort of, I think, in a way, one of my best chapters in my book, too, is the whole question of neighborhoods changing. In the late 1960s, neighborhood after neighborhood in big cities in this country changed from largely Jewish to largely black. I tell that story through a family in Chicago, the Epsteins, who were committed Jewish liberals. They march with Martin Luther King when he comes to Chicago in 1966, and they're committed that they are going to live in a integrated neighborhood and that their kids will live there as well. One of the things they discover is that as more and more blacks begin to move into their neighborhood in Chicago, the Jews begin to leave, the streets become more dangerous, the schools deteriorate, their synagogue moves out of town, and their Jewish community center closes. And finally, one of their children comes home after having been beaten up at a hockey rink and says, you know, Mom and Dad, you believe this integration stuff, but we're living it. I think that the encounters between blacks and Jews in the North very often were very troublesome. And I think that what happens with the civil rights movement when it begins to take a more northern focus after 65, when the struggle moves north, is that a lot of those abrasions come to the surface. And I think it really is the time when black-Jewish relations really begin to hit the rocks, because they're in a sense that those kind of encounters breed a certain amount of anger and bitterness on both sides.
Well, do you think, I wonder whether you think that there is more... there is more anger and bitterness on one side or another, or it's fairly equal. I sort of get the impression that many Jewish people feel that they're, especially looking at the history of their involvement in the civil rights movement, that there are a lot of Jewish people who feel that they're really the aggrieved party, that somehow they did everything they could, they saw it as a struggle of everybody, and that somehow for all of the effort that they put into it, they got slapped in the face.
Well, I think frankly, there's an equal amount of anger on both sides. In fact, at one point, I thought of calling my book, instead of Broken Alliance, I thought of calling it It's Their Fault, because that seems to be how both sides very often view it. I think that Jews certainly feel that way, but I think many blacks feel that Jews somehow left the movement when it got a little too close for comfort. That, in other words, I mean, it's interesting, when I speak to blacks and Jews about that golden era of cooperation, those early days of the 60s that Paul Parks and Jack Greenberg and others were part of, Jews tend to be very nostalgic about that time. But blacks, by and large, are not, because I think many blacks resented the kind of paternalism that they felt hovered over those early encounters. And I think that when black power began to arise, many blacks I spoke to for the book felt that Jews of all people should understand why blacks would want to control their own organizations, why they would want to control the direction of the civil rights movement. And many blacks are very angry when Jews take that personally and they begin to leave and resign in disgust. Many blacks say to me, that somehow Jews only wanted to be part of the civil rights movement when they could benefit from it or when they could control it. When I speak before black and Jewish groups, actually, I find it's almost like these fundamentalist churches where people stand up and testify. Mm-hmm. Usually blacks and Jews stand up and tell very personal stories, often very painful stories about how they felt. So I think both sides feel quite aggrieved in this, and that's one reason why when I think about this issue and talk about it and talk about the book, I think in some ways it may really lie in that younger generation of blacks and Jews, people like Donna Brazile, who were too young to march with Martin Luther King to try to restitch the alliance together. Because I think there is a lot of anger, a lot of hurt feelings, a lot of baggage that many blacks and Jews have carried from the 60s and early 70s, and that it may really be better for the younger generation to talk about it, because they can talk about it perhaps in less emotional terms.
Yeah. Well, my phone lines are full. I have several people who'd like to join us, so
okay.
Let's go right back to the phones then. Line number two is our next person.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to point out, I guess, and then have your reactions, that there are still quite a few American Jews that share Well, actually, I was thinking of Arthur Kanoy, who was still involved in the Rainbow Coalition, and they still see a shared interest, and they still feel that they are a marginalized community in this culture, and that it's important for, you know, it's not a matter of we're helping them, it's a matter of a coalition that still does exist to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is, and I'll waive any follow-up since you have a full house, is I see the anti-Semitism in the Bush campaign, the way that was such a non-issue, and the way that anti-Semitism in the Rainbow Coalition, quote-unquote, where it's actually anti-Israeli policy, the fact that that is such a major issue is shows that it's really it's purely manipulative, and that it's a non-issue for some political reasons, and it sort of, since it's not even-handed attack on anti-Semitism, it makes one wonder about its sincerity on a lot of levels. So if you could comment on that.
Sure. Right. On the second question first, I mean, I think that much of that is tied to what I said earlier about many Jews sort of expecting anti-Semitism from the right, but being surprised when it comes from the left. I think the fact is that most Jews still feel the Democratic Party is their home. And the fact that there would be anti-Semitism in the Republican Party, I think, while it troubled many Jews, somehow didn't surprise them. I think that what they see in the Jackson campaign and the Rainbow Coalition is a fear that somehow that they will not be welcome in the Democratic Party either. I think that explains part of the reaction there. But it is true that many blacks have said to me when I've spoken about the book, you know, why is it that Jews seem much more worried about someone like Louis Farrakhan than about Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell, people who, as fundamentalists, clearly, you know, can pose real challenges to Jews and sort of the diversity and pluralism of this country. It is true, as you were saying in the first part of your comment, that there are Jews who are still part of the Rainbow Coalition. In fact, many of Jesse Jackson's key advisors are Jewish. In the last campaign, his campaign manager was Jewish, his issues coordinator was Jewish. There were a number of Jews there. I would argue that those Jews, while they are Jews, do not represent sort of how most Jews feel. The fact is that Jesse Jackson got, I believe, as much as 20% of the white vote during the Democratic primaries, but only 3% of the Jewish vote. I think most Jews are actually not only disagree with Jackson, but are in fact quite afraid of him. One of the surprising things I've discovered in talking about Broken Alliance and traveling the country over the past few weeks is the genuine fear that many Jews have about Jackson and his power. It's not just that they feel he is somehow they disagree with him. It's deeper than that.
What is it that they're afraid of?
Well, I think they're afraid of two things. I think they're afraid, first of all, that his positions on Israel and his support of Palestinian rights will imperil the security of the state of Israel. I think they're troubled by his unwillingness, as they see it, to come down strongly against Farrakhan and to speak out about comments like that. I mean, Jackson has denounced Farrakhan's comments, but has said he will not repudiate Farrakhan personally. And I think that's a distinction that troubles many Jews. They don't understand why he's doing that. I think at root, basically, Jews don't trust Jesse Jackson. I very often, to black audiences, compare it to if Ronald Reagan stood up on Sunday and gave a speech saying he now supported affirmative action, was going to cut off all aid to South Africa, and so forth. I think a lot of blacks would say, well, what's he really up to? I think many Jews feel the same way towards Jackson, that there's just a level of mistrust, which goes beyond the Haimetown remarks and so forth, and really it's very hard, I think, for them to hear what Jackson has to say without wondering if he's sincere about it.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Jonathan Kaufman, the author of the book Broken Alliance, The Turbulent Times Between Blacks and Jews in America. We'll go on to another caller, line number 3, our next person. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I came into the program a little late. I don't know if anybody's really talked about this. But, you know, I can understand the alliance between blacks and Jews before the end of the 60s. Shortly before I was born in 1950, my father moved to a New York suburb, and he had wanted to do that for many years, but it had been closed to Jews until about 1950. There were no Jews allowed. There were towns on various train lines on Long Island that proudly announced, closed community, no Jews and blacks. but he was one of the first Jewish people to move into this particular suburb. I remember when I was applying for colleges, many of my friends also found that there were informal quotas at certain prestigious universities, certain number of Jews only. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, New York University used to be called NY Jew because all the kids that couldn't get into Columbia because of their informal quota would go to NYU. So it's called NY Jew. And so it was, you know, seems very natural that, you know, there was an alliance to, you know, expand civil rights because it did affect the Jews. And I just wonder if what's happening now is just the effect of Americans' notoriously short historical memory.
Well, no, I think that's precisely right, as we were saying earlier, that it was this sense that I think many Jews had, that while the civil rights movement would benefit blacks, it would also benefit Jews as well. And you know, Jews, in a sense, I mean, I think one of the things that troubles many blacks, I mean, this was brought up recently when I talked about the book in New Orleans, was that many blacks were saying, you know, why is it that Jews never talk about how the civil rights movement benefited them? I think what you're talking about is part of that. I think that the Black Power movement, in many ways, opens up the ways for all American ethnic groups to rediscover their heritage. There's an explosion after the Black Power movement of Jewish studies, Hispanic studies, women's studies, and so forth. Affirmative action. I mean, while many Jews have opposed it, some of the biggest beneficiaries have been Jewish women who have been able to move into law and medical school because of affirmative action. I think you're right. I think that the lack of historical memory, especially when I speak to younger blacks and Jews, is quite profound. I was at Yale recently giving a speech, and a young Jewish student, probably 21 years old, came up to me and said, you know, my parents tell me about all the Civil Rights Coalition and about Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, those three civil rights workers, two Jews and a black, who were killed in 1964. He said, but the only way I really know blacks is through affirmative action, and I know it's going to be harder for me to get into law school because I'm going to be competing against blacks. When I speak to younger blacks, too, I mean, they have a sense that either Jews have just become white and they're just part of the power structure, or they know Jews in the context of opposing Jesse Jackson and criticizing Farrakhan and so forth. So I think that the country as a whole, and especially the younger generation of blacks and Jews, have forgotten what this alliance was about, what it accomplished. And I think it's one of the things we have to do. I mean, there's a wonderful program out of Philadelphia run by Congressman Bill Gray, who's the congressman down there. And he basically takes younger black and Jewish students, high school students, student council presidents, people like that, and he takes them first to Senegal so they can see where the slavery began, where the ships left from, then to Israel, and then to Atlanta, to the Martin Luther King Center, to talk about the civil rights movement. I think programs like that are terrific because it really gives blacks and Jews a chance to learn about their own history, to learn about each other's history, to learn together and teach each other. And I think that we need more programs like that and more outreach like that to allow and to force blacks and Jews to remember what it was they shared in common and what they were able to do when they worked together.
Let's take another caller here. We'll go to our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I would like to introduce a premise. First, I want to start with that I am not Jewish and I'm not black. I think we're talking about a discriminatory process that is one-ended. There's two different types of discrimination, in my opinion. One that evolves out of a sense of jealousy, and the other one that has a condensation to it, where you consider yourself better than. And the Jewish image and the black image is not the same in this category. I think the Japanese are very close to coming into the Jewish circle. You have succeeded in the marketplace. You have succeeded markedly, academically, professionally. So as a consequence, the discrimination that exists against the Jews is one of jealousy. I think that the white America as a whole considers themselves better than, unfortunately, the black man. Now, the black man is being reminded that the Jews have succeeded, and he, perhaps their success is not as obvious. And I think as a consequence, he's joining the ranks of the whites from the standpoint of his own sense of defensiveness. Now, do you think there's any rationality to that?
Well, I mean, there's some. I think there's some elements to that. I think it certainly. I mean, I guess the way I would put it is that I think many blacks looking at Jewish success in this country sort of say, well, you know, if we started out on the barricades together in the early 1960s, how come Jews have done so well and blacks, by and large, have not, although many blacks have, but clearly as a group, blacks have not. So I think there is sort of an element of envy, I guess I would call it, in that. I think, though, that in a way, the sort of the way blacks and Jews look at each other blind them to the realities of this country. I think that one of the, I sometimes feel like Henry Kissinger shuttling between black and Jewish groups and to other groups that are trying to explain people to each other. One of the things I try to say to blacks and to other non-Jews is that Jews are historically insecure. I mean, the fact that Jews are doing well in this country, I think, makes it somehow masks the sense that Jews still feel that their well-being is not assured. Jews were doing very well in Germany before the Holocaust, very well in Spain before the Inquisition. So that even the blacks are sometimes puzzled, why are Jews worried about blacks? But Jews, by definition, worry about their status in the society, even if they're doing very well. I think on the other side, I think Jews, like many whites, still don't understand the reality of what it's like to be black in this country. And I think that there is a sense in which most whites have forgotten the kind of struggles that blacks have had to face and still have to face. So I guess I would interpret it somewhat differently, but I think there are a number of things you're saying which are quite true, that there is a way in which the two sides, because they may have a different way of looking at the world, may bring that to bear and may look at the same issues and see them in completely different ways.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I have two callers holding. Unfortunately, we won't be able to take both of them, but I will get one of them here on line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I wanted to suggest that beyond this Jewish mother controlling the black rights organization syndrome that you suggested and the envy and other such things, Jews are simply a minority that is more available to criticism, violence, etc., still in this country as everywhere else in the world, than would be the white majority. Mm-hmm. And in the process of self-assertion, especially among the younger black, it is simply easy to direct the anger at such a minority. It mm-hmm. simply has fewer harsh consequences
right.
than going out against everybody.
Well, I think that's true. I think many Jews certainly feel that way. And I guess my feeling is, and I feel this way having written the book and having spoken to black and Jewish groups extensively in the past month or so, sometimes it seems blacks and Jews are so good at fighting with each other that they've become like boxers in an arena, sort of very good at sort of pounding each other's solar plexus and finding each other's weak points. And I think in doing that, in picking on each other the way they do, they sometimes forget who's in the grandstand watching. Very often those people in the grandstand are people who don't like blacks or Jews. They're people who thrive on black-Jewish division, who relish the way it enervates the Democratic Party and hurts progressive causes. And I guess my hope is that at some point, blacks and Jews will put down their boxing gloves long enough to say, well, who really benefits from this? Does it really help both of us to hammer away at each other, or is there a way we can still unite and find common agendas to try to move this country forward and then make it a better place, not only for blacks and Jews, but for everyone?
I do want to try, and I do have that one last person, and if they can make their comments brief, we'll get them in here before we have to finish. Here on line number two. Hello.
Since you mentioned slavery and ancient history, which was involved with the Exodus and the slavery of the Jews, I would like to remind you of an aspect of Jewish history that perhaps you're not aware of, and that is that the Sephardi Jews, who were expelled by Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain in 1492 after much persecution, the Sephardis who moved to New Amsterdam and later New York, later called New York, established their wealth on slave trade, on the Roman slave trade between Africa and the West Indies, and thereafter transported slaves to the South.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I know. I mean, there were Jews who were involved in the slave trade. There were Arabs who were involved in the slave trade. I guess my feeling is, and sort of the point of my book, is that this whole question of black-Jewish relations is really an American problem. And I think that, that the way to solve it, the way to bring blacks and Jews together, is to focus on this country and focus on the sort of disputes and disagreements that blacks and Jews have here. And by working those out, as difficult as they may be, I think there may be a way to try to bring these groups together. That's been my focus in writing the book, and I think it really is the way for those who want to bring blacks and Jews together to begin.
Well, I wish we had more time. Unfortunately, we'll just have to leave it at that. It's quite an interesting book. I appreciate you spending the time with us this morning.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
And for those who are interested in reading more about this, I suggest you take a look at the book our guest has written. His name is Jonathan Kaufman. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe, and his book is Broken Alliance: The Turbulent Times Between Blacks and Jews in America. It's recently been published by Charles Scribner's Sons.